podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. This episode is brought to you by Charles Tirrett, pros in effortless menswear, whether you need a casual weekend look or sharp tailoring. For the month of June, we're offering our listeners 20% off at Charles Tirrett with the code WISDENPOD for use online and to quote in store. A busy show lies ahead. At the time of recording, England are 2-0 up in their ODI series against the Netherlands after breaking all sorts of records in the series opener. Catherine Brunt has announced her retirement from Test cricket. The Blast group stage is reaching its climax. Chris Silverwood is enjoying a quietly impressive start to his time with Sri Lanka. And as well as all that and more, we've got some of your questions to answer. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker, and the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner. But before we go to them, let's hear Mark Butcher's thoughts on the England-Netherlands series, Owen Morgan's future, and Jamie Overton's England Test call-up. Butch, we're talking the day before the last game of the England-Netherlands series. Have you enjoyed your 2 days off in Amsterdam?
Yeah, it's been all right. Played golf badly for 2 days and got a couple of early nights in. The weekend was rather lively, has to be said. But yeah, it's been all right, mate.
What are your overall impressions of the series so far? I mean, from the outside, the atmosphere looks amazing. And with the differences between the white and red ball squads these days, it seems like the kind of local tour that England could actually take part in more often than they have previously.
Yeah, I guess it probably could. It's a bit of a trial run for Cricket Netherlands, who I think were a little bit surprised by the volume of people and their, enthusiasm. For the overstrength beer that they sell here, so things were a little bit chaotic in the first game, and then they got their act together a bit more for the second one. And I suppose it's a great opportunity, I suppose, if you're thinking about it from a fan's point of view, for that, you know, not everybody can afford a month in the West Indies or the, you know, going down to South Africa or wherever else, you know, the travelling fans like to go. And so, yeah, it's a really good opportunity to see the England team in action away from home. And of course, it's not overly costly to do so.
And then obviously, we'll get to England in a second, but Netherlands are missing quite a few of their first choice players. Have there been any Dutch players who've caught your eye so far?
Yeah, I quite like the look of Tim Pringle, the left arm spinner the other day, actually. Scott Edwards, yeah, the 250s looks, you know, a decent enough player. But I mean, they're massively outclassed, aren't they? I mean, the interesting thing will be on Wednesday if they decide to play on the same pitch again, you know, which will have been, what, 6-7 days old, I suppose. And that might give them a chance. You know, you run the risk of not scoring very many runs yourself and losing the game. But if they play on another fresh one, which has always been the plan, then you just wonder if England might make 500, you know.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because they don't get to host international cricket with the eyes of the world on them that often. So on the one hand, they want to show that they're capable of producing international standard tracks. But if you give England the best pitch in the world, they're going to score a lot of runs, and Netherlands are unlikely to be able to overcome that. Whereas if they have a slightly stodgier surface, that's probably their best chance of actually getting a result.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the wickets they took in the run chase, you know, that slowed England down on Sunday were, you know, due to the fact that the pitch had dried out quite a bit and there was a little bit of turn happening. So, you know, it gives you a chance. That is for sure. But no, look, I think it's been terrific. You know, the surface was a belter on day one. It was still pretty good on the second game. The welcome that, you know, the fans received and whatever, albeit, like I said, they were a little bit sort of undermanned and underpowered on day one, but they rectified that on day two. I think it's been pretty good. Pretty good.
You alluded to the chaos off the pitch in the first game, but on the pitch there was chaos as well. Butler's innings was was absurd. He pretty much broke every record there is to break. Tim Wigmore of The Telegraph wrote that since the start of 2015, Butler only faces on average 23 balls per game. Do you think he bats too low in ODI cricket? I mean, the move up to the order in T20 cricket that was basically based on the logic of let's give your best bat the most balls has worked and then some. Can you see England in their kind of next phase of their white ball regeneration looking to do that in the ODI game as well?
Well, I suppose it's certainly tempting. You know, everyone was dying for Darren Millan to get out on the Friday, which is no reflection on the way that he played, but simply because, you know, you knew there were more brutal hitters to come, i.e. Liam Livingstone, etc. Look, I think England will probably talk about it, but don't forget, if you're playing against South Africa or Australia, you're not, you know, with all due respect, you haven't got Logan Van Beek and people like that. You know, you've got Kagiso Rabada running in at you. You might want to hold Joss back a little bit. And 50 overs is a very, very long time. So, look, in these circumstances, you can understand why that sounds like a tempting thought, because you're unlikely to kind of be three or four down due to some wildly good pace bowling in the power plays, but I think under normal circumstances that you would probably keep it similar. And you know, Joss came in at four, didn't he, on the Friday, having, you know, he'd probably be in, you know, I don't know, down to come in at anywhere four, five, or six. And the key to England's success in all white ball formats is the fact that they're flexible enough to change things when the game situation requires it. And so, you know, I imagine that's probably what they'll still do.
It's almost as if he comes in after a set number of overs rather than in a set batting position. Obviously, there aren't a huge number of talking points in this series, but the one that is kind of emerging, even if it's confected a little bit, is Owen Morgan's form. What do you see his ODI future looking like? Because a few weeks ago, he said that he's not committing to the 2023 World Cup just yet. He's not playing back-to-back blast games because of his body, and he's not in great nick, you know, over quite a few T20 tournaments. And when everyone's back, he's probably keeping Liam Livingstone out of the ODI side. He'll be 37 when the World Cup starts. Do you see his ODI captaincy surviving that long?
No, frankly. I'm a bit surprised. And look, I'm sure, Owen being Owen, that he's kind of thought about this and has thought about the, you know, the succession plan prior to that 2023 World Cup. It would be extraordinary if he hadn't, you know, he hadn't got some sort of idea in place as to how the whole thing is going to work, and that, you know, we're just waiting to hear what that is. But yeah, I can't see it, honestly, because Liam Livingstone needs to be in that side. And the strength of striking power around that squad just means that, you know, there just isn't room for somebody just to be captain of the side. It doesn't matter how good that captain is. And I'm guessing that the part of Owen's thoughts on all of this will be that, you know, Joss will be ready to take over when, you know, we've spoken about this and Joss is ready. We've kind of got it in place. I would be staggered if he tries to make it through to the 2023 World Cup. And that's not because of two ducks against the Netherlands. I mean, frankly, who cares? You know, that doesn't matter. But I just think I was surprised that he didn't announce that he was done with it after they won in 2019. And we're now 3 years after that. And he's still going. So, look, he'll probably prove us all wrong and, you know, come back, great fitness, have an extraordinary run of form, and lead the side in the next one. But at the moment, that looks like a wild fantasy, doesn't it?
And then on the bowling front, what do you make of Brydon Carst as an international cricketer? He bowls a good pace. You know, he touches 90 miles per hour every now and again, and with a lot of injuries, a possible test cricketer as well.
Yeah, he's the timing of his sort of recovery from injury has been good for him and for England. And yeah, I mean, there's a role there for him, isn't there? There's the obvious Plunkett comparison in terms of England's ability to take wickets in the middle overs, which they've, you know, actually they've struggled to do a little bit in this series against the Netherlands. So England will be very keen to sort of bring him along in that role and give him as much time to bed himself in and to get used to the skill set and the, you know, and work out the plan in his head as to how he's going to do what Liam Plunkett did, you know, which was lots of changes of pace, lots of short balls. you know, and be a real wicket-taking force for England in those middle overs. And, you know, there's a spot there for him if he can crack it. So, timely for him. And he's got a lot of great attributes. You know, his run-up is really smooth. He's a really big, strong guy. And he will, and I think he'll get quicker as well. He'll be able to generate more pace than we're seeing in sporadic bursts at the moment. So, yeah, I mean, the world's his oyster, really, in terms of that white ball side.
On the test stuff as well, a bowler not that dissimilar to Carr is Jamie Overton, who's in the England squad, test squad for the first time for the Leeds test. He's an exciting pick who's done brilliantly in the county championship this year.
He has, yeah. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that Jamie Overton was kind of didn't know when to let the ball go. You know, he was bowling multiple sort of over waist high full tosses in blast games. He wasn't getting much of a run out for Surrey in anything else. And you know, he's worked very closely with Azza Mahmood. Azza's the bowling coach down there at the Oval. Azza's got his action in great shape. And he's sort of delivering on a promise that you know, people were talking about him as a potential England player 5-6 years ago now. Because he's got genuine pace, you know, big strong guy and genuinely can get the ball down there. So wonderful that he's making a resurgence. When did I speak to Azza about this? Probably April, wasn't it? Something like that, after a pretty eye-catching performance in one of Surrey's wins at the Oval. It might even have been against Somerset or Hampshire anyway, it doesn't matter. And, you know, he said really happy with his progress, but he's not quite bedded in yet, you know. And perhaps now, 6 weeks later, that is the case. I'm sure that Rob Key knows Azza Mahmood very well. Obviously, they captained him when he was at Kent in that spell. I'm sure they will have spoken. And if they think it's a good plan, then great to get him back in the fold. So, yeah, great. I mean, it's a really good story because, you know, too often, I think young bowlers or young fast bowlers, they kind of, you know, if the early promises doesn't get fulfilled, then they kind of, you know, they end up sort of drifting out of the game altogether. So good story that a man now, how old is he now?
28.
Jamie, what, 28? Yeah, I mean, he's coming into the prime of his career. So, you know, a young man who's had a bit of a blip, is finding himself back in there again and has that drive and hunger to improve and, you know, to try and win a Test match cap. Brilliant.
Ben, how do you see Owen Morgan's England career going from here? We're recording this during the final Netherlands ODI, which Morgan is missing through injury. It's not just the form that the odd double failure happens, it's his fitness as well. And with ODI cricket in particular, that World Cup is still quite far away.
Yeah, I suppose there's a few things to say. Because as you say, the form in T20 cricket, his form has been just uniformly bad for quite a long time. But the question seems more around the ODI captaincy. And in that, he's only played 5 50 over games since the start of last year. So, and in one of those, yeah, match winning 75 not out. So it's harder to say what his form is in that. And the fitness thing, again, can only be figured out by playing it. My instinct is, and I think it's right if it's happened, is that Morgan will and should give himself July, basically. England played 12 games in July against Africa and India, 6 ODIs and 6 T20s. If he and England struggle and his fitness isn't what it should be, then that could be the time. But if he gets himself back into form, I think that upside is bigger than the downside of not giving Joss Butler 6 or 12 games as England captain and Liam Livingstone 6 more games in middle order. And I think he has earned the right to know for absolute certain that he's got nothing left to give, I think. So I think that's will be the key time. I think these games really won't have too much sway either way in the decision, and that'll be the crunch moment, I think.
Ben Stokes announced this morning that Jamie Overton will be making his debut at Headingley. It's 9 years after he was first named in an England squad. He's now 28. Phil, we've talked to him about him a couple of times this summer, but what should we expect from Overton in the Test arena?
I think it's good news for England that it's not good news that Anderson is injured, of course. So that's a concern, by the way, because it's, you know, it's a pattern that is developing a bit with Jimmy. But anyway, we'll come to that another time. What can you expect from Overton? Pace and aggression, and they haven't fielded a bowler with those traits in the first two Test matches. Obviously, in this new gung-ho approach, this is exactly what they're going to need. You know, you can't go into a Test match under these two blokes and have a kind of pea shooter attack, albeit a storied one, of course. So that's what you'll get. He's not just going to be the enforcer, although that will be part of his role. Taha wrote a good piece on the website yesterday. He spoke to Gareth Batty about him, obviously his coach at Surrey, and they've been trying to drill home to him that he's more than a explore the middle of the pitch, stick two men out and a short leg type bowler. There is more to him than that. And I've watched a lot of him this year, and that's exactly what I've seen as well, that he's bowled telling spells in the midst of a game with a ball that's 40-50 overs old, and that's what pace can do. And he has bowled full from time to time, and he's got the ball swinging late here and there. The ball of the year so far from a seamer that I've seen was his ball to Matt Renshaw in the Somerset game back in early May, maybe late April, early May. But it was a sunny day, and it was at the Oval, so where it doesn't do that much in the air. It wasn't like it was up at Headingley, you know. And it's just arced massively back into the left-hander from right arm over. It's dream delivery. Renshaw leaves it, as you would, and it cleans him up, takes his off stump out of the ground. So he has that. He's a transformed quick who was really struggling at Surrey when he made the move up from Somerset. Azam Mahmood got hold of him at the start of the summer. He's the bowling coach at Surrey, and he said, Mahmood said to Batty, give me some time with him and I'll get him right. I'll get him right for you. And that's what's happened. He's, you know, he has a different run-up, so he's now accelerating through the crease properly. He's not trying to force it down there, and he's bowling within himself 80%, 85%, and yet still getting it up around that kind of number, MPH as well. He can break 90 mile an hour, and that's been confirmed by the ECB's ball tracking technology or whatever, ball speed data that they've been trialing at certain county games. But the naked eye tells you that.
There's a really good quote from Ben Compton earlier in the season. I think it was to the Times. He said that Jamie Overton was... I mean, Ben Compton has faced, by the way, more balls than anyone else has in the country this summer. And he said that Jamie Overton was felt 10 miles per hour quicker off the pitch than any other bowler he'd faced all year. And he faced some very good bowlers up to that point. So Jamie Overton is genuinely quick. I don't think he's just Stone Wood level quick, but he is right up there, high 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, and it's worth saying as well that it's kind of come from nowhere a bit in that Overton wasn't massively in the conversation at the start of the summer after he struggled last year. But up in that move to Surrey was kind of seen as almost like the last thing he needed to check off, come here and on a flatter pitch, show that he could do it on that as well. Before that, his record, I think because he was rarely playing 14 games a season, so he wasn't putting up loads and loads of wickets, but actually for 4 or 5 years, he was averaging like low to mid 20s in the ball. He came really close to a test call up. It's basically a toss up between him and Ollie Stone at the end of the 2018 summer when England wanted an out and out quick. These were the two guys. Both had extraordinary records that summer and they just went with Ollie Stone. So although this has come, and obviously it's been talked about a bit, this has come quite quickly from this point, but also it's not that surprising that once it's clicked, England have got him in quite quickly because there's clearly quite a lot to like.
And he can bat as well, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, he's averaging 50-odd, I think.
And that's improved, actually. That's improved in a way almost more than his bowling, I think, even though that's what's wonderful.
Yeah, and he gives it a whack. And again, that will appeal to them because, you know, they don't have a number eight and he could potentially grow into that role. He's got the ball striking ability to be like an 8.5 at the moment, but with a bit of experience at test level, you never know, he could become an 8, which is obviously something that they're crying out for.
And it's not a like-for-like replacement at all. The closest thing to a like-for-like replacement would be picking his brother Craig.
Yeah.
And also, it's not a selection without risk. Jamie Overton, as you say, the run-up's only been remodelled this summer. He has always been a bowler who does go at more than 3 and over generally.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He bowls hitable balls.
And you've got Matthew Potts, who's only going to be playing his third test match as well. So it's another bold selection from McCullum and Stoke.
It is, but from what you've seen from Potts, even though he had a trickier second test, he hits his lines and he hits his lengths pretty consistently, Potts. So I think you can go in there with a degree of confidence that he's not going to get kind of hit out the attack. Overton, you're right. I've seen him, as I said earlier, I've seen him bowl a lot. So I have seen him bowl not so well. I've seen him look for swing and over pitch quite a lot. And when you're bowling at real pace, then you do, it flies off the bat, as we know. So, but I don't think they're going to be bothered. I don't think they're going to be bothered about a bowler that's going to go at 4.5 and over. If you end up with 3 for 100 from 20 overs, Stokes and McCullum will say thanks very much.
And it's, and especially because even though England have won the last two Test matches, there have actually been two very long spells, one in each of those Test matches, where England haven't really looked that penetrative and have looked quite short on ideas. So it's quite proactive that even in victory, England are looking at this early stage in the McCullum era to go on and improve.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, you say it's, you can't just look at pure averages and pure economy rates, like the impact of wickets and when a guy bowling will go a long way to how valuable they've actually been. And Jamie Robinson could be that, they'd say, point of difference a lot, don't they? He could be that point of difference bowler.
David Stump asks, we're currently in a sweet...
Is that his real name?
I don't know.
Right, okay. Stage name. We're a cricket lover.
David Stump asks, we're currently in a sweet spot of a resurgent England, nice weather, and before all the infighting and culture wars kick off with 100. The best few weeks of cricket in a long, long time in this country? Question mark.
Yeah, good point that.
It has been nice.
It has been lovely. The weather's obviously helping us. There's been... I've been impressed with the county stuff that I've seen, and I've really enjoyed it. The clouds are over the horizon, for sure, and he's bang on there. And culture wars might be the phrase of the day, but it absolutely applies in cricket, just as it applies in all other walks of life at the moment. Yeah, we are... It's not going to always feel like this, and quite soon it's not going to feel like this. But at the moment, considering what cricket went through towards the back end of last year, with the explosion at Yorkshire, the necessary explosion at Yorkshire, and the necessary, you know, internal assessment of its soul, if you like. You know, it's badly phrased, but you know what I mean. And then obviously a stinker of a winter, and it was harrowing to watch Joe Root, you know, denuded of his team and no self-belief left and just staggering out of that. Considering where you were then, it's been a kind of rousing couple of months for the game, and I totally agree with him there. Can totally see where he's coming from. I really, really hope that the 100 goes off well. It doesn't win or negate any arguments, and those arguments will continue to run. And there are glimpses of the impact that we, you know, the fact that there are minimal games on Sky, for example, of the blast, which wouldn't have played out in previous years. You know, this is another of these kind of unintended consequences, or maybe some would say intended consequences. I just hope the 100 goes off well. I hope that there's some good games. I hope that the crowds come out as they did last time. From what I've heard, the ticket sales are very good. Obviously, that's another culture war, the cost, as we've discussed before. I really hope that it goes off well. As I say, that doesn't silence or embolden one side or the other, but cricket needs a good summer. It needs a good India Test match, for example. You know, I'm quite looking forward to that game, by the way. I think it could end up being a classic one-off game that bizarrely becomes more memorable for the fact that it's a singular thing on its own terms.
And it's only pretty much end of next week as well.
Yeah, I know. Come thick and fast, all this stuff. But it's a really lovely... Was it a tweet? Or was it an email?
Yeah,
it's a beauty by David, that.
We are about to enter, what, like 14 days of consecutive Test cricket, or 13 days, I think, of consecutive Test cricket? That'd be pretty fun.
Yeah. And on that, the big news in the women's game this week is that Catherine Brunt has announced her retirement from the Test game in a retirement statement. Brunt said, I feel like as an athlete, there is never an obvious time to step away from doing the thing that you love. But over the past 2 years, thoughts of retirement have surfaced more and more. So I've decided to make a smart decision rather than an emotional one. Test cricket is my absolute passion, and to retire from this format was truly a heartbreaking choice to make, but it allows me to prioritise white ball cricket. Brunt is just one of two women who played Test cricket this century to have taken more than 50 Test wickets. She averages less than 20 against Australia and less than 16 in Australia. In her last Test match, she took 8 wickets in that amazing game at Canberra earlier this year, where England nearly chased down 260 from 48 overs in the final day. Ben, a brilliant Test career, but with Brunt and Shrobsole no longer available in Test cricket, those are two very senior players who'll be difficult to replace for the South Africa Test that starts on Monday at Taunton.
Yeah, well, it's a massively new look squad, because it's not just in the pace department there's going to be changes. From looking at the squad, it looks like, I mean, they've only really got 5 batters in there who have played Test cricket. So you'd expect Emma Lamb to come in and probably open, so everyone keep the position that they've done, which will be an ask for her, but she's a very exciting player. It'll be interesting to see. And then even then, probably it'll be Alice, Davison, Richards, I think, at number seven. So you'll have two new players in that top seven even before you get to that pace attack. And then it might just be that it's one of the new quicks that plays and that Kate Cross is sort of the experienced head in the side. But then also they might think that sort of height is the way to go because they have struggled to take 20 wickets in test matches, and it might be that they want that height as well as sort of pace and seam up and skill.
So then it's
stuff.
Lauren Bell
and probably Emily Arlett as well, who's pretty tall.
She's
as well.
She's in the squad as well, yeah.
And Freya Davies is the other quick in there. So I'd say that the bowling attack could go one of a few ways, really, because that's if they play both spinners, which they probably will because Eccleston's the best bowler in the world and Charlie Dean they see as a wicket-taking threat. But they might also get to the pitch. I mean, it's a taunt as well, so maybe that'll turn, but they might get to it and actually think this looks quite green. We only need one spinner. And then all of a sudden, all three of the new quicks are playing. So that's where the question is, I think.
I think Lauren Bell's maybe half a step ahead of Emily Arlett. She's been groomed for a while now to take over that new ball slot. She's tall, she's got pace, she's got really good action. So, yeah, look, it's the right time for Catherine to move aside in the four-day stuff.
Yeah,
sure.
It was quite interesting. Lisa Kightley, the England coach, gave a press conference the other day and she's basically saying that at Bront's age and with a lack of cricket under her belt, it was just a risk her playing the test match. Yeah. And with the busy summer ahead, with the Commonwealth Games, which Bront is prioritising, it was just what they saw as a risk that was a little bit too
I imagine she'll be on the commentary team and she's a scream, so that'd be great fun. She's going to be a great commentator once she knocks it all on the head.
There was no place for Lauren Winfield Hill in that squad, but she was included in an A squad who are currently playing South Africa in a three-day warm-up game, as well as some of the centrally contracted players who missed out on the test squad. There are some very young players in there, I think five or six teenagers, so a very good opportunity to take a look how they get on in Red Bull cricket, because obviously there aren't that many opportunities, if any, for young players to play Red Bull cricket in the women's game at the moment. On the first game of that, Sarah Glenn took a fifer.
Who's opening with Beaumont?
Emma Lamb.
Is that confirmed?
Not confirmed, but from looking at the squad, it seems like pretty much the option.
Yeah. Okay,
moving on to the county game. Let's start with a bit of transfer news. This morning, Lancashire announced the signing of India all-rounder Washington Sundar. That'll do wonders for the streaming numbers, I'm sure. He'll be available for the whole Royal London One Day Cup campaign, as well as some of the rounds of the county championship, depending on how successful his injury recovery is.
I'll tell you what, it's a really good sign-in. Not just for, you know, your cheeky sardonic lines, which are fair, obviously. There'll be an element of that, but I mean, he's a quality cricketer. And Old Trafford in mid to late summer, if they can get him in a white shirt for three games, that could be critically important for him.
I'm intrigued to see what he actually does in Red Bull cricket, because he's not played that much first class cricket because he's been injured, and then before that, COVID wiped out the previous Randy Trophy season, and he's probably batted better than he's bowled in Test cricket, and he has opened the batting, I think, in Indian first class cricket when he was a teenager.
He made a stunning 60-odd, didn't he, against Australia? Maybe on his debut, I think it was.
So I wouldn't be surprised if he like opens the batting and is a second spinner alongside
Parkinson.
It's a
really
Parkinson.
Good signing. So, really
yeah.
Good signing. And also, Lancashire have got that history with overseas that once they get them early, they do tend to hang around. You know, obviously Wazim, but Murali kept coming back as well. And it's a really, really good shout, that. They're doing a lot of things right, Lanks.
And after Hassan Ali earlier in the summer as well, that's a seriously good pair of overseas signing. Moving to Yorkshire, David Willey and Tom Kohler Cadmore have announced that they're leaving Yorkshire at the end of this season. Willey is returning to North Ants while Kohler Cadmore is heading off to Somerset. Not going to lie, I found the David Willey departure statement slightly jarring. I'll just quote a little bit from it. He said that the cricket and the current players seems to be secondary at the moment to repairing the club's reputation. It certainly felt that way for me over the past 12 months. I'm not quite sure how a player can say that, given all the stuff that's happened in the last 12 months, that should have not been addressed in the way it has done. And I'm also not quite sure on the practical consequences of addressing Yorkshire's recent historical problems with racism, what that practical effect is on the players in the dressing room.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree that it's a jarring statement, and that it's one of those things that even if there is like a motivation, it's understandable, it's kind of best kept behind closed doors. I think part of the reason that he made the statement was that he felt that Yorkshire had misrepresented his reasons for leaving in their release. So his release went in, quotes in the Northants release, said that he had a statement saying that, you know, the right time to return home, that sort of thing. It was very sort of, you know, straightforward thing. Yorkshire's statement from Darren Goff said that Northants had given him a contract offer that they couldn't match. And I think Willie wanted to partly to head off the impression that he was just leaving for more money, basically, that this was a selfish decision rather than something that was right for him for lots of other reasons. I mean, you're right that if, you know, Yorkshire, it does seem odd that the two would have to come into conflict, you know, the sorting out the off-field stuff and keeping the on-field progress going. That shouldn't have to be the case. And if it is the case, that wouldn't mean it wasn't the right thing to do. They should take, you know, a few seasons of bad results if it means they can continue to exist as a club, which is what the stakes are, basically. But then from a player's point of view, and as I say, this should stay behind closed doors, shouldn't be something that should be aired in public. But if you are a player with a short professional career and you feel that the club you're at isn't doing the best to maximise that, then it would make sense to seek opportunities elsewhere, I guess. I think one of the things that I saw reported somewhere was that the Yorkshire basically came to the table late in the contract talks with Willie, that had basically slipped down the priority order. And I can see how, as a player, that makes you feel undervalued, even if that's all for completely legitimate reasons. And there is a bigger picture here. I'll see that as a professional sports person, perhaps you have to feel a certain amount of selfishness at certain points to go to clubs. As I say, jarring statement, completely agree. But
very nuanced view. On to the Blast. Surrey is still unbeaten. They beat Somerset in a kind of odd thriller at the Oval last night. They won it off the last ball. Peter Siddle took 2-2 in the last over before Connor McKerr hit the last ball for 4. There was an amazing moment when Gus Atkinson got bowled off the penultimate ball of the game. He tried to play off stump York. He tried to guide it down to third man before, missed it. Will Jacks was unbeaten at the other end and he goes crazy, like jumps up and down like a like an angry toddler, and then walks off to a standing ovation when McKerr hit the winning
run. It's a club that's forgotten how to lose.
Yeah, it's great. So they won that game without Pollard, who's out for the rest of the whole tournament.
Yeah.
Pope, Jamie Overton, Curran, Roy, Topley, and I'm probably forgetting a couple as well. So for them to keep winning with that calibre of players out is seriously impressive. My moment of the week is from the Blast. I was watching the end of the Derbyshire Northants game yesterday, and they chased down 187 with ease. So Derbyshire in the last week have now beaten Yorkshire, Birmingham and Northants back-to-back to go second in the North group.
And Middlesex in the four-day stuff.
Yeah, you wanted to talk about that last week.
I did, yeah. We did.
This
we
is a chance.
Time,
this is a chance.
Yeah, I mean, Christ, I can't remember what happened in the game now. It was a 4-wicket win, but again, Middlesex flying high and to win a tight one, it just shows what Mickey A is doing, and it's rousing stuff. It really is. You know, anybody who looks at the carve up of the county game. Can't fail to be moved and thrilled when one of the perennial kind of shorthand for failures, isn't it? You know, Derbyshire, Leicestershire, how many players have they produced for England? Blah blah blah, all that stuff. Well, it's amazing what you can do with a couple of good acquisitions and a coach that can just genuinely imbue a little bit of self belief into some players. And they've got some good ones. You know, I don't know how you pronounce his name. Is it Deploy?
Yeah,
Louis Deploy. Yeah, near enough. He's having an absolute stormer. You know, I think he beat Yorkshire basically on his own. I think they needed 19 off the last, and he did it in 5 balls. He was not out in the Northants game at the death as well, wasn't he? So these kind of players whose names percolate around the game without really having too much of an identity, they are suddenly beginning to perform regularly.
Wayne Manson, it's in the cricketers who's who when you ask who's got the best shot in the game, and half the country comes back with Wayne, not even one Wayne Manson shot, it's 5 or 6 different Wayne Manson
and he made
shots.
What, 70 odd in 30 balls last night.
Yeah.
So it's great. And obviously Shaun Massoud is, you know, we gets a nod every week on the show, and he's been the player of the year.
And also pod favourite Mark Watt going under 8. Again, he's having a very good summer.
And on Deploy, he is one of the few players in the world with a proper signature shot, in that he plays the scoop shot like no one else. He does it with the back of his bat. He puts bat backwards and then ramps it over the keeper that way.
But I checked.
Pioneered by Andrew Simons there, by the way.
I checked. He does it deliberately, so you can watch it once or twice and think, oh, he's just kind of mistimed it, and he's made it up on the spot. But he does actually practice that. And also, Phil, on your point as well, it's quite heartening looking at that North group table. I mean, you can come to a conclusion when you see Surrey 9 from 9 essentially in the South group, that the rich clubs are dominating the blast. But if you look at the North group table at the moment, you've got Derbyshire in second, Northampton in third, Leicestershire in fifth, Yorkshire in sixth, Notts with a star-studded T20 side struggling in seventh place with just 3 wins from 10. I mean, one of the stories of the blast, I guess, is 17-year-old leg spinner Rehan Ahmed, who's suddenly become a mainstay in that Leicester side after impressing the under-19 World Cup. He took 4 for 22 the other day, and a couple of massive googlies did serious numbers online. So it's been a really, really good and exciting blast campaign. And to be honest, Surrey are through in the South group, Lancashire are doing well in the North group. But other than that, it's kind of all to play for, with maybe like Worcestershire, Durham, Sussex and Kent basically out of the running, but the rest of them.
Friday night blast. Did you watch any of it? Yes.
I watched some of your show with Dan Norcross. Do you want to explain what it is? So Phil, listeners, is part of this new, I guess it's Soccer Saturday for the Blast, basically Friday night blast.
Cricket's Jeff Stelling.
And you're Chris Kamara to Dan Norcross.
If you like. Red Zone. The American football version is probably a better comparison because you do have the footage and you can go to the commentary from each game. But yeah, we had a little studio at Lords, an otherwise empty Lords, but the Wi-Fi is good. And we had 8 screens and a master screen and a little screen of us two Herberts as well. And we did our best over the course of over 4 hours to bring as much of the action as possible to the punters, and to move from one game to the other. And you know, there's been a leg bye at Wantage Road, Dan, and obviously you can't cover every single wicket, especially down the pipe when things are going berserk in each game. But for a trial run, in effect, you know, it was soft launched a couple of weeks before that, and Mark Church and Matt Floyd did it, formerly of Sky, and then it was launched a bit more on Friday night. And while there will be some teething problems with it, I suppose, and a couple of the feeds weren't quite as strong as others, which we've seen as well. But this is an emerging new media for cricket. We haven't fully nailed it yet. But the fact is that this wouldn't have been possible a couple of years ago or even last year, but the counties are moving along the line. And while me and Norcross staggered out, not for the first time on a Friday night in fairness, but we staggered out knackered at the end of it. It was a good thing to be a part of, and hopefully, you know, it can grow from here and become a relatively regular staple of people's cricket. And it, you know, because the Blast needs it, right? It needs that kind of context, I think.
And our long-standing criticism of the Blast is that it's impossible to follow, and this does make it, when you've got what, 7 or 8 games happening on a Friday night, it does make it.
Did you think it worked? Be honest.
Yeah, no, genuinely, it does. It does. Well, one thing that I think will just get better over time is like the snappiness between games and stuff like that. That will surely just get better over time.
Yeah, So there were technicians running in and out constantly and fiddling with wires while me and Norcross just spouted.
Norcross fiddling with your mic as you spoke.
Yes, yes. You watched it right at the end. Blimey, so some people were still watching after 10 o'clock. Wow.
Chris asks, should there be squad limits on county squads? The size of Surrey's, Lancashire, Warwickshire's, etc. is huge compared to the smallest counties. I basically think no, because the bigger teams with more international players lose those international players. And you look at Surrey at the moment, they've got so many players missing. They had to give a debut yesterday to young Nick O'Reefer. That was his first T20 game. So they do need squad sizes that big, I guess.
Yeah, and there is a salary cap, even though some of the smaller counties don't really get near it. That there is that in place, well, to sort of check the, you know, the rampant ambition of your Surreys and your Lancashires and whoever.
We've got a question in from, and his username is important here, by the way, at Cornwall Morris asks, there's constant chat about possibly losing a few counties from the professional game, but if you had to add one to the current group of 18, which county would you pick? Any reason is valid. Phil, you had an answer straight away when we talked about this before the show.
Well, I don't know if it stands up, but Berkshire are the dominant team. And
they've won three out of the last four. No, I checked it. They've won three out of the last four.
Right, okay. And I met a bloke actually at Lords who's closely involved in the Derbyshire, in the Berkshire sort of cricket association, if you like. And he was saying that there's immense kind of natural resources, if you like. You know, there's a lot of real interest in the game throughout the county, and obviously there's kind of built up areas as well, sort of around Reading and so on, that would benefit from the club, from the county becoming first class. And that's what happened with Durham. They just became so good and so dominant that it became this sort of unstoppable train, if you like. I don't know enough about Berkshire to be sure on that. Geographically, Cornwall Morris is bang on, because, you know, we could certainly do with another focal point down there, right in the deep west.
I mean, Devon, Cornwall obviously, but Devon are producing a lot of good players at the moment. The Overton Twins, Don Bess, etc.
Yeah. Well, that's the other.
And it's a hotbed for cricket down there.
That's the other argument, I suppose, that Berkshire might have the best record, but if all the players who were born in Devon played for Devon, they would be, I think, a pretty strong team. And there is a Devon and Cornwall 2 Somerset pipeline a bit, and you wonder if there could be a Devon and Cornwall 19th. I originally misread this and thought it was if you had to lose one for any sort of spurious reason, who would you lose? And I had to go for Leicestershire, not for the normal reasons, but because if you want Americans to get into cricket, you can't have a team they're going to pronounce Leicestershire.
So edit that up.
Beautiful. Elsewhere in the international game, Chris Silver's Sri Lanka have beaten Australia in an ODI series. Ben, he's had a really good start to his time in charge. Sri Lanka beat Bangladesh in a test series in Bangladesh, which not many teams do. And this is a strong Australia side. And Sri Lanka, as we've been talking about before on the show, have a pretty poor recent record in ODI cricket.
Yeah, and that Bangladesh series was kind of the Silverwood template, if you know, batting big. And he talked about the first 12 balls being key for a bowler, all very sort of obvious things, but also the right things to focus on, I guess, especially if you're a side who are looking to improve quickly from quite a low bar. And yeah, this Australia series has been great after seeming like it could be a massive blowout. I mean, the first game, Australia won it by 10 wickets in the T20s. And then since then, it's been close all the way through. I mean, they've kind of traded blows, but Sri Lanka have been the better side by a margin since then. The game that's almost most worth mentioning is the third T20I, which was just ridiculous.
Is that the mad finish?
Yeah, so Dasan Shanaka is the captain, was 6 off 12 balls at the time. Sri Lanka needed 59 off the last three. And then Australia brought on Josh Hazlewood to bowl. He's basically unhittable at the moment. And then he just took off, and they won it with a ball to spare. He ended up 54 off 25, I think. So that would be, what, 49 off his last 13 balls? Apparently the most runs ever hit off the last three overs of a T20 to win it. So that was ridiculous. But then it's kind of been, that was freakish, I suppose. What's been encouraging is that since then it's been
sustainable.
Exactly, yeah. And contributions from lots of different players. And as you say, young players, like, yeah, Asalanka, Pathanasanka's made 100. Winindu Hasaranga's still young and one of the best white ball arounds in the world at the moment, really, considering that you don't get many people who can bowl leg spin and hit sixes in the way that he can. Kusum Menis isn't quite so young, but you'd really fancy him to have like sort of three golden years, I reckon.
I was going to mention him because he got a run of all 80-odd in one of the games, I noticed. And with him, you never know if he's going to be in the side or not. But he's got, you know, a lot of natural ability, and he was really highly thought of a few years back and had a kind of stinker of a run, had a couple of injuries as well. So to have him back, I think he was batting three there as well in that game. And yeah, I'm really pleased for Silverwood. Good man. Brute of a job with England. Atherton wrote he was out of his depth. I think there was a sort of, you know, unavoidable element of truth to that statement. That said, as you say, Ben, you know, his philosophy, if you like, if you can combine those components, that idea, with a lot of natural ability that's maybe not been focused too much in recent years, then that becomes quite a useful combination. And we've said about Sri Lanka, predating Silverwood, we've said there's a lot of good young players coming through, and they've got pace in their attack. They're always going to produce watchable batters. So, yeah, it would be really, really good if they can come again. And they will, because, you know, they love cricket out there.
And I guess with Silverwood as well, there's so much more than just being a cricket coach to being the England head coach, if that makes sense.
Especially for him. I mean, well, firstly, he was selector. And then also, yeah, by the end, he was, you know, booking net times and doing all that kind of stuff. Like, it was a shambles by the end. And I think he was basically doing seven jobs and wasn't very well suited to a lot of them. But the thing that I think he might just be quite a good coach in and of itself, as in he can take players and make them better players. I mean, and you know, it kind of has been almost written from history now, but England were an improving side and actually quite a good side for the first 18 months he was in charge. You know, they won four series in a row, two of them were away from home.
Won it up in India.
Yeah, and with a young team that looked like had the core or something, and then obviously everything fell apart. But that, like, if he can just focus on just having a group of players that he knows and can get to know him and the other stuff, then there's no reason why he can't be a good
And it's not that similar a job, because as we say, it's a very young squad. I mean, one player we've not mentioned in the podcast before, Denith Welaalagoo, was one of the players of the Under-19 World Cup. He's been batting seven and bowling left arm spin. And then between him, Hasaranga and Mahesh Tikshana, you've got three very different young, very good white ball spinners. So they've got the core of something that they can really take forward. Unfortunately for Sri Lanka, that series is not part of the ODI World Cup Super League, so they're still in quite a lot of trouble in that. In India, South Africa drew 2-2 in a T20I series against India. The decider was rained off. And in the Caribbean, West Indies are 1-0 up against Bangladesh. Kemal Roach taking a hatful of wickets there.
And Kyle Mayers as well.
Kyle Mayers took a couple.
Nipping in. Amazing.
Can we just say something about Kemal Roach? Just that, yeah. that five for in the third innings came when it just looked like Bangladesh might put up a bit of a fight, set West Indies 150 or something, and there could have been a bit of a dogfight at the end. So it was a really important spell, and he's quietly just put up a record that kind of ranks among kind of a lot of West Indies great bowlers. He's now
he went past Marshall or Holding?
No, he's joint with Holding.
Right.
He's 10 wickets or so behind Joel Garner. So he'll probably end up fourth among West Indies quicks behind Marshall, Walsh and Ambrose, which is massive. I mean,
with an average, it's almost identical to Anderson as well.
Yeah, and the Anderson comparison is quite an interesting one, because quite a relevant one, because he started as a proper tearaway. I think if you remember in one of his first few series, he basically heralded the start of the end of Ponting's career when he troubled him with a short ball, broke his hand, I think, and that was something that people then targeted Ponting with from then on. He is no longer a tearaway. He kind of had a bit of time in the wilderness, sort of rediscovered himself and reinvented himself as almost like an Anderson-like low 80s bowler, very consistent, lots of skills. And he has been the linchpin of that attack for a time when West Indies have really, really needed a linchpin. You wonder where, as much as they're at a low ebb at the moment, like where would they be without Kemal Roach? It kind of doesn't really bear thinking about.
And it's a really exciting attack as well with Roach, and you got Seals and Joseph, who's been playing Test cricket for a while, but haven't really seen him bowl with the kind of the accuracy that he had in that first Bangladesh Test match as well. So yeah, maybe England's defeat in the West Indies wasn't so bad after all. Here's a question from a listener, Sid. Longtime fan of the magazine, have loved it since his All Out Cricket Days, a precursor to Wisden Cricket Monthly. I started reading it when I was 8 or 9 years old. I'm now 27.
Makes me feel old, Sydney.
And I started listening to the podcast about 2 years ago. I have a question for the pod. If you have time, please could you discuss some interesting cricket books you've read this month? I know we have a section on books in the magazine, but some coverage on the podcast would be nice as well. There is
an assumption in that question.
I love you, Sid.
thanks for continuing to read, my man.
There's quite a sweet assumption in that question that we read multiple cricket books a month. I personally don't. The most recent cricket book that I read was Cricketonomics, that we talked about when Tim Wigmore came on the podcast a few weeks ago, which is, as I said it then and I'll say it again now, is a brilliant and fascinating and almost essential read, I guess, if you want to understand the economics of the game at the moment. But Phil, you wanted to talk about another book that is not yet out.
Yeah, I did. It's good timing by Sid, because I wanted to talk about this anyway at some point this month. This is a book which I think is going to win lots of awards, and I think it should win lots of awards. It's an extraordinary thing, and it's called Being Jeffrey Boycott, right? Now, if anyone's read, have you read The Damned United by David Peace? Do you know of it?
I've watched the film.
Okay, the book is a great bit of work, and The Damned United tells a story of Clough's 60-odd days at Leeds United in the early 70s, and it's done as a kind of imagined historical fiction. Getting inside Clough's mind, and based obviously on a lot of texts from the time. Anyway, this book has a similar kind of feel. However, it's a joint effort between John Houghton, one of the best cricket writers around, and boycott himself. And it stemmed from the first lockdown, well, the first stage of the pandemic. Boycott decided on a whim to sit down and try and remember, and he does have an extraordinary memory, Boycott, try and remember every one of the 108 test matches that he played, right? And remember the conversations that he had and the hotels that they stayed in and the team talks and the, you know, the sort of mini machinations around a test match week and sitting by the radio waiting to hear if you're in the squad and all of these details, the big and the small, he tried to put it down on page. Now, because this is Boycott and because he has this extraordinary memory and because he has this amazing dedication to what Hotton describes as the one love of his life, the true love of his life, which was playing cricket, he wrote and sent a Word document that landed at my colleague's desk, Matt Thacker, who is the chief publisher of Fairfield Books. The document came out at 111,877 words. 111,000. And Matt read it and thought it was amazing and then showed it to John Hotton, who's always had an obsession with Boycott and has written very beautifully on Boycott for WCM and various other publications. Hotton then got to know Boycott and they developed some kind of friendship and have now collaborated on this book. And it is a first-hand account from Boycott of these 108 games and a second-hand account with Hotton's incisions, if you like. And it comes out as this extraordinary combination of writerly brilliance in Hotton's hands and the license that you have, although, of course, he's done his research and he's spoken to Boycott and he's based a lot of Hotton's bits on what Boycott's written in the first place in that 111,000 words. And it transposes Hotton's bits with Boycott's first person account. So it's a really brilliant combination. I don't think I've ever seen, certainly never in a cricket book have I seen this before. I just want to kind of just read a little bit. This is Hotton doing Boycott. If you like, Hotton talking to Boycott. This is from an early chapter. You've just, from 1962, okay? And Boycott's averaging 20 something for Yorkshire and he's struggling and he's a 22-year-old bloke in spectacles and he's
not a test cricketer yet.
Not a test cricketer, slightly socially awkward, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke. He's a man slightly out of place in that Yorkshire dressing room. This is Hotton. You have just finished breakfast at the Salisbury Hotel in Scarborough before the match against Warwickshire at North Marine Road when Brian Close, back from England duty, finds you and says he wants you to open the batting. No, thank you, Captain, you tell Brian Close. Well, you have a choice, Close says. You can either open the batting or not play. I've taken the decision to make you into an opening batsman because your technique, temperament and approach to batting fits it. Now go and do your best. You do. You always do. You finished the 1963 season third in the national batting averages. You've opened the batting for many teams, but you've never liked opening the batting. You do now. Close is right. It suits your game, that immaculate technique, and it suits your temperament. You like the certainty of knowing when you will bat and who you will face. You can prepare for certainties. You can structure a life around 11:30 a.m. on the first morning of a game. And that's just a bit of Hotton for you. And then it goes into Boycott's own first-person account. Mm. So you're constantly jumping back and forth. I know I've gone on about this
this is really interesting.
But it's a truly brilliant bit of work. It comes out in a few weeks' time. In fact, I think it comes out... it comes out next week on June the 30th. It comes out, and Boycott will be up at Leeds signing copies, and he'll be here and there around the course of the summer. He's put his heart and soul into it, and I think it humanizes the bloke in a way that will take many by surprise, I suppose. And for those who are sympathetic to the epicness of the Boycott story, it will be an absolutely essential read. It's a brilliant, brilliant piece of work.
Let's try and get him on the show to talk about it.
Oh, I've had words.
Okay, excellent.
Watch this space.
Listeners, Ben's moment of the week is related to this quite long question, so bear that in mind as I read it out. This is from Shervo, who, if you don't remember, is our listener who's emailed in a few times in the past. He only discovered his love of cricket during Alistair Cook's Farewell 100 at the Oval in 2018, and he's recently started playing the game. Shervo says, firstly, thought I'd follow up on my nascent cricket badgerdom after you helpfully sent me all those YouTube ideas last autumn. I've been playing a bit for the last few weeks, my score growing exponentially with each match, naught, then one, and then last week two not out over several overs in what turned out to be the longest partnership of a lackluster innings. It sounds like a small thing, but I was a nerdy kid growing up, so playing any kind of sport is something I've never really done before, and certainly not something I expected to start in my mid-30s. It's brought me a heck of a lot of joy so far this summer, got me out of the house, not to mention the great feeling of contributing to a team. I'm grateful to my long-suffering but patient teammates who endure my lacklustre batting and terrible fielding. Anyway, all of this has led me to realise it is a very difficult game to pick up as an adult if you've never played cricket before. So I wonder, what do the team think can be done to get more adults into playing cricket recreationally, especially those who like me who didn't as youngsters? So much of the focus is on involving kids, which is great, but given the obvious mental and physical benefits of playing the game, could more attention be paid to helping older people take it up for the first time? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. Ben, you didn't play cricket as a kid, and you played cricket this Saturday. So first of all, what was your experience of doing that?
Well, this was my first cricket match for 6 years or so since we had a sort of a silly game out on the Oval. And this was for also quite a silly game for Jim Wallace's stag do. But it was fun. I suppose if I had to pick a moment of the week from it, it would be Taha Hashim's whip through mid-wicket, sort of back leg in the air. He looks very good in a cricket jumper and with a collar pops. He had a furrowed brow, no helmet on, not a hair out of place.
And crucially, it was photographed as well.
Yes, he looked extraordinary. But I've got no talent for cricket really, no training, but I had fun. I think one of the keys was that it was pairs cricket, and I wonder if this could be something that is actually in a way rolled out a bit more widely for people who are trying to get into it, because if you want to go and play cricket, no matter what level you are, you can kind of find a game to play. You'll be able to go and play a Sunday game for a village team who are desperate for an 11th player. The thing is that you might get to play but not be involved too much. Like if you might get a bat, but you'll get out within the first few balls, and then you might not get a bowler. If you do, you get an over, and then they'll realise, you know, that you actually don't really know how, and it's kind of hard to learn mid-game, and that I don't know what training facilities there would even be for people to go and get training as an adult, as a beginner. But with the good thing with pairs cricket is you can have the rule set up so that if you get out, you lose runs, but you don't actually get out. So you can actually have fun doing something that is competitive, but without that thing that is what makes cricket great, which is, you know, the fact that one mistake can lead to, you know, your day being over and sort of thing, but also that does make it quite impenetrable for someone who is not as good as everyone else they're playing with. So I don't really have a solution, and I don't think, you know, cricket is going to change its formats overnight, but that
that's
the barrier, I think.
I think it's a really good answer. I mean, there's a reason why kids play pairs cricket at the start, right? And also, I think you're also right that so often when you're getting into the game, you're brought in as a ringer for a team that's playing 40 overs on a Sunday. And that isn't exactly the most welcoming format for someone who never played before. I would actually recommend, if possible, if you're getting into the game, playing last man stands cricket.
I was going to say that.
If you're in an area that has a last man stands league. I've got a friend who, very similar to Shervo, only got into the game a slightly later, basically 2019 World Cup, in his early to mid-20s, and he really wanted to start playing, played a little bit during lockdown, and he now plays last man stands cricket, which is 7 or 8 a side.
It's 8 a side.
8 a side. You play it on an Astro in a park, and you're still out when you're out, but the standard is lower. It's not taken as seriously as club cricket is. I think that's better and easier to get into. The games don't take too long, so if you do get out quickly, you're not, you know, sitting there all day watching people as done and dusted within 2 hours. I think that's worth doing, and I think also, I guess, maybe taking the focus away from playing matches initially. I've got a friend who, again, is a guy who plays for our third 11 who only started playing during lockdown. He goes to the Nets loads, and he's actually pretty good for someone who only started playing in 2020.
So I think it takes a bit of guts, I think, to walk into Definitely. A net, especially if you are starting from scratch, or if you're looking to go again, if you like, having played a little bit when you were younger. But you will always find a welcome there. And if there's a few people playing in a net, they will, trust me, they will be happy to bring another person in, share the load, You know, and if you bowl for half hour, you'll get a bat for 5 or 10 minutes. That's the etiquette of it all. So yeah, it can be a bit daunting for sure. But yeah, get in there and you will inevitably meet people. You'll talk to people. They will have Sunday games if you want to get involved from there on in. And look, I'm on various WhatsApp groups with sort of friendly cricket clubs. You can have 55 names on that thing, but they're still struggling to get more than 8 players on a Sunday. So there are games out there, but you have to take that jump a little bit.
Mm. If anyone's listening to this, our third 11 is still short for Saturday if you fancy a game in Thamesden. Phil, let's hear about your game on Saturday because that sounded quite fun.
Yeah, well, I'll keep it as brief as I can. I played in the first team at my club in the Essex League and we got 233 in our 50 overs. It's a time game, but we batted our full 50 overs. And at lunch or at tea, had my tea, went downstairs with a cup of tea and walked along the corridor and there was a bloke already in his pads. And I hadn't seen him when we were batting, really. I hadn't really paid much attention to their fielders. I saw him and he just looked like a cricketer, okay? And I thought, oh, you're going to get runs. I didn't say a word to him, just walked past him with my cup of tea and I thought, oh, you're going to get runs. Everything about it worked, right? All the muscles were in the right place. The pads were perfect. The thigh pad didn't bulge out too much on one side. The helmet fitted immaculately. And also, crucially, tellingly, gun and more bat, gun and more gloves, gun and more pads. We go out to defend 230-odd. And this chap got 135 in about 25 overs and was out comfortably before the end. So got 135 in about 170, 180. No one knew who he was from our team. We're not the most diligent of blokes, I suppose. Turns out he's a chap called Grant Rolofson, 25-year-old, South African, 47 first-class games at an average of 41, highest score 224 not out, 800s. 38 List A games, average of 43, highest score 147 not out. And he is last year's South African One Day Player of the Year, on the cusp of making his international debut. Now, look, this is all part of the fun, sure. And this, in first team cricket, you get these lads, you know.
I mean, it is worth saying.
But my God, I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, mate. But your first team player actually a very high standard of club cricket.
Yeah, so it's not kind of freakish, yeah. Sure, to have a really good overseas cricketer, you know, and he'll be on the payroll at the club and fair play to him. And this is at Billericay CC in Essex. You know, they're a really brilliant club. Essex 2s play there. So sure, it's not freakish by any means, but it was funny that we kind of came off, sat in the dressing room. Yeah, that was a good knock. Anyone know who he was? Nah, no one really knew. So I sort of Googled and had a look. Turns out he's this lad. But I couldn't help but enjoy it. We've got a really good bowling attack and a couple of quicks. One in particular, you know, bowled a sharp spell. And as I say, Essex 2's play there, so it's a good pitch. And he was just pulling you right in front of mid-wicket. You know, just sees it so early, right in front of mid-wicket. Just a stunning knock. We lost at least half a dozen cricket balls during it as well.
My question was, if you're playing at that standard, do you have to look really, really good to stand out in terms of just how you're carrying yourself?
Yes and no. You know, there's still, for all that, there's loads of talent there. And another lad got 90 batting with him, but there was no, it was clear who the pro was. And the lad who got 90 batted beautifully, right? But his trouser leg was halfway up his arse and, you know, the jumper didn't quite fit and all of that. And his bat was a bit knackered and taped up and all of that. And so, yeah, it's still club cricket, but then you just have this sort of shimmering beast who emerges out of the dressing room and he's already 70 not out before he's faced a ball, you know. Anyway, it was all good fun. We got smashed as clearly.
Mm.
But yeah, it's good fun to dip my toe into first team cricket. I don't play much of it, you know, mainly because I'm probably not good enough for it, but it was fun anyway.
You made a running ball 20, Phil?
22 from 23. Yeah.
I also made a running ball 20 this weekend, so good week for that. Anyway, that is all we have time for on today's show. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Ben. We'll be back straight after the Headingley Smash.
Social Podcast Network.